Today's speaker, as you know, is Professor C.V. Sundaram. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to introduce my senior colleague in the same institute. Professor Sundaram is currently, as you also know, a visiting professor with the National Institute of Advanced Studies. He was the former director, or rather he is the former director, I'm sorry, of the Indira Gandhi Center for Atomic Research, Kalpakkam. Professor Sundaram is a postgraduate diplomate of the Indian Institute of Science and Metallurgy from the, from 56 to 82, he was involved in research in the metallurgy division of Bhabha Atomic Research Center, Bombay. While at Kalpakkam, he provided the direction and coordination for the completion and commissioning of the fast breeder test reactor. Currently, efforts are in progress to take the reactor to power level operation. He has been closely associated with the activities of the Indian Institute of Metals. He was associate editor of Transactions from 65 to 72 and editor of the same journal till 1980. From 78 to 81, he has been chairman of the Metal Science Division, and in 81-82, he was the president of the Indian Institute of Metals. Professor Sundaram is affiliated with various scientific, academic and societies and is currently president, Indian Nuclear Society, Bombay. He has received many awards and recognitions, including Padma Bhushan, and has a number of publications to his credit. Professor Sundaram will address you on a very exciting subject, materials and society. As you know, he has two lectures, first today and the second tomorrow. May I now request Professor Sundaram?
Thank you, Dr. Sen, for the introduction. I only wish to make one amendment that I am not the president of the Nuclear Society now. I was the president till 1993, and currently Dr. P.K. Iyengar is the president of the Nuclear Society. Members of the faculty at NIAS, Dr. Sen, and fellow participants in this course on integrated knowledge and information. I deeply appreciate the opportunity that has been given to me to address you through two lectures this morning and tomorrow on the subject of materials and society. Now, the subject of materials has already figured in a variety of contests in the course of our own program in the last 3 weeks. Quite a few of you have presented during the self-introduction lectures your own individual experiences in the field of production of materials, use of materials, and also the development and management of materials. I know quite a few have a specialized knowledge of individual sectors of this field. I am also aware that three of my own former colleagues in the atomic energy program, Mr. Sarat Chandran, who is presently at the nuclear fuel complex, Dr. D.K. Bose, who is the metallurgy division in Bhabha Atomic Research Center, and Mr. Boje, who is now director of the reactor group at Kalpakkam. All of them have given you a detailed idea of the development of special materials for the nuclear program. So what I shall attempt to do in the course of today and tomorrow is to supplement the knowledge and awareness that's already with you. Even otherwise, even if you have not been involved in such a manner recently, all of us know that we need and make use of materials in our everyday life. Though we may not all the time think deeply about where these materials come from or how they are fashioned for our use. For example, if you look around this hall where you're assembled, you can see the large variety of fairly common materials that have gone into the construction of this hall, in the windows and fixtures, the furniture that we use, and even the mat cover for the floor, and of course the electric power supply and the sound system. When you go back to your living room or you see the fittings in the bathroom, you again see a different variety of use of ceramics, metals of a variety, and also plastics. And when we go out and travel in any form of transport, again, we recognize that materials have played a part in the design of the transport system, whether it is the automobile or the railway compartment or the aeroplane. Now, it's not as though humanity has suddenly arrived at this large variety that is at our command today. The earliest man had the use of only the natural stone, wood, bone and skin to work with. And in comparison, the variety of materials that we use today is a bewildering variety. And today, whereas in an earlier phase we used to teach metallurgy as a discipline or ceramics and glass technology as a discipline in our colleges, there has been an attempt to integrate the whole field of materials, science and engineering into an integrated course. And today it's not as though we have arrived at the limit or the capability of materials. We are getting to know more and more about them and also understand their behavior. We are able to design now materials for specific advanced applications. I shall try to outline for you before I proceed what will be the structure of my lectures. I should give you a background to my own involvement with materials that give me the credentials to address you on this subject. A few months back there was a seminar that was organized near Madras, an Indo-French seminar where scientists from both sides, India and France, had participated to survey the history of science and technology in both the countries. And I had been invited to give a talk on the history of chemistry and metallurgy in India from ancient to medieval to modern times. A copy of that lecture I'll be distributing at the end of today's lecture. In the context of that lecture, I had the opportunity to study ancient and medieval history relating to materials in our country. And I would like to cover some of those aspects in the course of my talk. Then today we can say we have arrived at a situation when we can talk of the science of materials. And the core of that science is how materials have a structure at various levels, from the nuclear to the macro, and how structure governs the properties of these materials. What are the parameters we have at our control, like composition, mechanical and thermal treatment, to control this structure, and how we design materials for specific performance conditions, and also situations where we have encountered metal failure. For all our knowledge, periodically we do encounter with spectacular and catastrophic failures. For example, during the Second World War, when the German U-boats were wreaking havoc on the British Navy, and Britain was losing ships at too fast a rate, Churchill appealed to Roosevelt, and the United States agreed to build ships to supplement to replenish the loss. And they could certainly come up with a situation of building ships at a very fast rate to meet the requirement, to meet the challenge of Hitler. But in the process, after some time when the ships were in use, there were catastrophic failures of ships splitting into two. And it required an analysis to find out why that was happening. It was the case of the Liberty ships, famous Liberty ships. And at the end of my two lectures, if you have the time, I will show you a video that's a 15-minute documentary on the Liberty ships and that failure. Similarly, in the early years after the war, when the jet plane had been developed and the British Overseas Airways Corporation were flying their Comets, during 1953-54, there were three explosive failures of Comets in different parts of the world. One was over India, and though Britain had detailed knowledge about designing planes, and that was analyzed to be a case of metal fatigue, because that was the first time when aircraft cabins were being pressurized, and when you pressurize and depressurize, metal components get exposed to what we call fatigue. Then, of course, the whole problem had to be looked into and analyzed for redesigning the structures to avoid initiation of fatigue cracks. And all of you know about the famous Challenger disaster that is much more recent. The space shuttle had been flown successfully many times, more than nearly 10 to 12 times. And then, after it had taken off, the subsequent flights, within minutes of the takeoff, the Challenger exploded to the shock of television viewers who were watching the launch. And it was a case where a small, what we may call a trivial component like a rubber sealing to isolate the fuel tank from the rest of the craft had failed. That was a case of a brittle failure of rubber, and that was a serious disaster which cost many American lives. So metal or material failure is a subject of continuous study, and in the course of tomorrow's lecture, we'll also deal with the subject why materials fail and how we can avoid such failures with the knowledge we have today of materials. And in the last part of my talk, I should certainly like to have a futuristic look at where we stand as a country with respect to resources and technology, and what should be our materials policy in the coming years, so that we not only become self-sufficient for a growing economy, but also come to a position where we strike a lead in the development of special materials, and also make use of our resources to earn precious foreign exchange to support our economy. That will be the broad scheme of my lecture, and I shall see to what extent I'm able to cover this ground. If you have a brief look at the history of man's use of materials, at the beginning of human civilization, with his knowledge of using fire, for building purposes, man learned to make bricks, as you would have seen in the presentation by Dr. S. R. Rao the other day. And of course, he started by using natural stone even before bricks were available. Then, in nature, we have copper, iron, zinc occurring in the form of various minerals. And in the earlier part of civilization, man developed the capability to make copper and bronze and even wrought iron, sponge iron, which was worked as wrought iron, to make his weapons and tools. Once he developed the knowledge of casting metals to shape, later on it developed as a force for developing printing technology, which was responsible for the spread of literacy. Then you know the use of the magnetic needle for navigation and travel, how man traveled far and wide, discovering new realms for his own exploitation. Then in more recent times, after the discovery of electricity, we have used copper, zinc and lead in the use of electrical energy, in transmission and also the building of batteries. And we have used tungsten, as we see today in the filament lamp, for designing the electric lamp. Uranium has been the basis for nuclear energy. Silicon for the transistor, solar cells and the computers. And I mentioned about the jet plane. As you design planes for higher and higher speeds, where even skin temperatures can go high, titanium has been used in the engines. And in some of the supersonic planes, titanium has been used also in the fuselage. I mentioned about the bewildering variety of materials that we have today. This is a plot that you have got a pointer. This is a representation of how from the earliest times, 10,000 BC onwards, to modern times, we have been using materials. And this plot shows the distribution of use as materials in civilization. The plot starts from 10,000 and goes to 2020. In the earlier periods, of course, stone was used. Composites like straw, brick, polymers like wood, skin and fibers. Metal, of course, as gold, copper for ornaments, iron and bronze for tools. And early man also has made pottery, glass. And the Romans supposed to have developed even cement. Now in the modern period, again, the distribution is between metals like cast iron, steels, rubber, and refractories, including Portland cement. If you come to very recent times, the use of metals has increased. You have a variety of metals, as you'll be seeing. Steels, alloy steels, the light alloys based on aluminum or titanium, super alloys for aero engines, and the nuclear materials. Side by side, you have had the development of the polymer industry and to some extent the advanced ceramics. As we look to the future, the indications are to some extent metals are likely to get substituted by other materials like polymers and composites. And ceramics, apart from being serving the needs of the earthenware industry and for room temperature service, will expand their domain to advanced engineering conditions, even as materials for engines. At least for automobile engines, we are thinking like we can use materials like silicon nitride or silicon carbide. We have now learned to combine the advantageous properties of metals and polymers, or metals and ceramics, the combinations of strength and toughness to design composites. So we have got a much better range and capability and understanding to utilize all the materials about this. But the interesting thing is, in earliest times also we had this spread, but in earlier times the use was more based on naturally available materials or easily producible materials. Today we have an advanced engineering of materials. To give you some idea of what is the current production of metals and materials, this is the these are the figures for 1989, that's the latest I could get. Iron and steel we can still call as the backbone of structural engineering. The world produces
800 million tons. Cement is a major structural material and component in structures. The world production is over 1,000 million. Coal is the primary energy resource. The production is about 4,500 million. In comparison to iron and steel, aluminum production is small. It is 16 million. But whereas iron was produced in the BC millennia, aluminum could be extracted as a metal only about 100 years back. And aluminum requires a lot of energy to produce. And one reason why the production of aluminum is not as extensive as the case of iron and steel. Then copper production is about 9 million, zinc 7, lead and so on. Nickel, for example, is less than 1 million. And when you come to special metals like titanium, which is used in the aerospace industry or in the chemical process industry, it's only about 100,000 tons of raw metal. Only a few countries produce. The uranium that supports the established nuclear capacity of about 300,000 megawatts in the world, the annual production is about 37,000. Silver, 14,000 tons. Gold is 1,900 tons. And the noble platinum is only 270 tons. So you can see the spread in production in quantity. Gold, 1,900 tons. Iron and steel, 800 million tons. And this is a comparison for you for the for India, and I put figures also for China, because that's a country with which we are going to compare ourselves. In 91-92, iron and steel production was about 15 million tons. Of course, I have got a figure for 93 as 16 million. This is mainly from the public sector plants, including Tata Iron and Steel, not including the contribution from the mini steel plants. While in China, for the same period, the production is 61 million tons. Our coal production is 230 million, China's 900 million. Cement production in India is 53, China's is 209. Our aluminum production is fairly good in comparison to the world production. It is about 500,000, likely to rise to 1 million by the turn of this century. China produces 800,000 tons. Significant production of copper, zinc and lead are not reported from China. We have significant production. The uranium figures I don't have for China. And our uranium and zirconium production are significant in the world context. They support our nuclear industry. Titanium is already produced to the extent of 2,000 tons in China. We don't still have a commercial plant for titanium. Then tungsten is an important item of production in China, 21,000 tons. China has one of the large tungsten resources in the world. Perhaps I could also show this, that this production that you see today has increased only in the course of the last century or so. In 1850, the world production of iron and steel was only 2.5 million tons. Became 28 in 1900, 260 in 55, and 800 in 1990. The world aluminum production was only 5,000 tons in 1900. Became 2 million 1944, it is 16 million now. In 1850, copper production was only 50,000 tons in the world, and today it is about 8 or 9 million. Before I proceed further, I should mention about what are the raw material resources, in what form do these various elements occur in nature. And we have iron occurring as iron oxide, and also magnetite. Aluminum as bauxite, which is aluminum oxide. Copper as a sulfide ore. Zinc again as a sulfide. Lead as a sulfide. Nickel as a sulfide. Tin is an oxide ore. Magnesium can be recovered either from dolomite on land or seawater. Sodium, our primary resource, is sodium chloride. For titanium, We have to recover it from ilmenite or rutile from the beach sands. Similarly, zirconium from zircon and beryllium from beryl. Some of these are simple oxides or simple sulfides. Some of them are complex minerals like zircon or beryl. Now you'll understand that the simplicity or the complexity of the mineral also will determine the complexity of the technology. And if man could process a copper ore or a zinc ore early enough in civilization, it is because when you roast chalcopyrite, you get an oxide which can be reduced with carbon to produce copper. Similarly, though not so easily, zinc sulfide, when it is roasted to zinc oxide, can be reduced with carbon. And I should emphasize that zinc extraction was first established in India around 2000 years ago, in the first millennium of BC, and that is a complex technology of which we can be proud. Then iron oxide also can be reduced with carbon, but the melting point of iron is as high as 1500 and above. And so in the early work on the metallurgical civilization, iron was produced more in the solid form. And only later, furnaces were developed to melt iron and convert it into steel. Various steps that we have to go through in the context of modern engineering for processing a natural deposit, you of course have the work of prospecting for deposits, mining and concentrating the ore. And then you have to treat this concentrate to produce what we call an intermediate compound. In the case of bauxite, you are not able to produce aluminum directly from bauxite, because bauxite is not a pure mineral. It contains iron, titanium and other impurities. So convert the bauxite to pure aluminum oxide, and then it has to be electrolyzed in a few salt bath to produce aluminum. That's why aluminum took a long time before it could be extracted. Then the intermediate compound is reduced to the elemental form. Carbon can be used, as in the case of copper, zinc and iron. Hydrogen is used in the case of tungsten. But many of what we call the rare metals today are produced by reducing the metal compound by another metal. For example, Mr. Saratchandran was presenting to you the technology of zirconium. All the zirconium that is produced in the world today is produced from zircon by first purifying the zirconium free of other impurities and converting it to zirconium chloride and then reducing the chloride with magnesium. Magnesium has a greater affinity for chlorine, so it pulls chlorine away from zirconium, liberating zirconium, and you produce zirconium metal. So this is called metallothermic reduction or by electrolysis, as we have in the case of aluminum. That was possible only after the discovery of electricity and the knowledge of electrochemistry. Then, today, very few metals are used in the raw form. You have to produce alloys by addition of other elements for functional purposes. Then, this alloy is processed through a series of steps in the flow sheet, what you call thermomechanical, using a combination of heat and force to produce the right structure, to achieve the right properties. Then you fabricate the various components. Use these components in actual service to get information about service behavior. And that information about service behavior is the feedback for the continuous improvement of materials. Though tomorrow I'll be dealing in greater detail about the science of materials, I should mention that these are some of the crucial steps in the progress of chemistry. Though the early Greeks had concepts about structure of matter in a rudimentary way, they also had thought of atoms. And in our own Hindu philosophy, the Vaisheshika philosophers had also conceptualized the composition of matter. As we understand chemical structure today, the credit goes to Robert Boyle in 1667 to define what is meant by an element as a basic substance that combines with other elements to form compounds, as you have seen in some of the representation of the minerals that I described, as a, and which itself cannot be broken down to any simpler substance. So if you have water, it is made up of hydrogen and oxygen. If you have got hematite, it is made up of iron and oxygen. And iron and oxygen are separate elements which are combined together to form iron oxide. And it was Lavoisier who discovered oxygen in 1771. We had an atomic theory of matter in 1803. Then we proceeded through various steps. And in 1955, when the field ion microscope was invented, we could directly image atoms. Till then, of course, we had understood that matter is made up of atoms and molecules, elements and compounds, but we could see atoms for the first time with the field ion microscope. And another important step was the organization of all the known elements in the form of a periodic table by Mendeleev in 1869. He arranged all the 92 elements in a systematic fashion, taking advantage of the knowledge of their properties. And once that was arranged, there was holes in that table, and those gaps were filled when gallium was discovered in 1875 and germanium in 1886. And these two elements have contributed to the development of modern electronics. Then mostly the English scientists could correlate the X-ray, the characteristic X-radiation from elements with an atomic number, the number of protons in the nucleus. And so the discovery of the rest of the elements also proceeded. And today we know as elements occurring in nature as many as 92. Some of them, of course, are very rare. And we also have produced new elements, as I will show in this table. This is how the discovery of chemical elements has progressed. In prehistoric times, we knew only about 10 elements, gold, silver, copper, iron, tin, mercury, sulfur, copper, zinc also. Then, in the 16th century, platinum was discovered, phosphorus in the next century. During 1700 to 1800, 15 elements were discovered, and the bulk of the rest of the discovery happened by 1900, 11 more elements during the period 1900 to 1940, and then beyond this period, commencing with the discovery of plutonium and neptunium by Seaborg, the transuranic elements were produced by bombardment of nuclei with charged particles in an accelerator. So 13 more elements. In 1940, plutonium had been discovered, and 13 more elements came to be discovered as transuranic elements. The count in 1980 was that as many as 188 elements are known, and some of them yet to be named. This is the same sequence, but showing the names of metals. Uranium and zirconium were discovered only as recently as 1789, titanium in 1791, and aluminum as early as 1827, as recent as 1827, and the neptunium and plutonium by Seaborg in 1940. Today, plutonium is available in tonnage quantities, mainly as a product of nuclear radiation. Spend a short while on the early Indian knowledge about metals. In the Arthashastra, which is a famous classic authored by Kautilya in the 4th century BC, there is a detailed reference to the traditional metals and their large-scale production. A very comprehensive account of ores and minerals that are extracted working is also described there. Codes for examination of precious articles to be received into the treasury. Detailed procedures for starting of mines and factories. The duties for the superintendent of gold in the workshop and the activities of goldsmith. And even process description for the purification of gold and silver by what we now know as the cupellation. I had mentioned about the Vaisheshika school. They had thought about the transformations that occur in matter and structure. When you fire, for example, a clay pot, And this was their rationalization, that motion produced in the atoms was responsible and the firing process. The original color gets destroyed, there's a new color produced. There is a destruction of the motion of atoms produced earlier. And there's a creative motion between atoms. And there is a disjunction between atoms and akasha. So on, they had their own intuitive understanding of what happens when you fire a clay pot to produce a fired red component. It's interesting that they could think in that detail. Because today we understand the sintering process in a detail, but a different way. I said that zinc was extracted in India even before the birth of Christ. And the evidence that we have today is a result of a project between the University of Baroda and the British Museum. They have radiocarbon assayed some of the timber supports, and they have determined the age of these supports as about 2000 years back. This was done in 1983. And at the Zawar site in Rajasthan, we have an impressive debris of the various pots that were used, reduction pots that had been used for extraction of zinc. They had designed special furnaces in two parts to heat the charge of zinc oxide and condense the zinc vapor at the bottom. They had used a charge of dead roasted sphalerite, that's the oxide, after the sulfur had been expelled. The high proportion of dolomite and sodium chloride as a flux, and of course carbon was the reductant, and the retorts were small, as you see, it had a central lute, and thin cow dung cakes had been used so that they could be placed on top of these retorts without crushing them. And we infer the temperature as 1250 degrees centigrade. The pellets were small, and each retort was capable of producing 300 to 400 grams of zinc, which was extracted in powder form and then used to produce brass. There is a continual production of zinc at Zawar to produce alloy. This is a schematic of the retorts that were used, fired clay retorts. This was the receptacle, and the essential detail is this temperature was 1250 degrees centigrade at which zinc will distill as a vapor. And if you don't condense it in a reducing atmosphere like carbon monoxide, it can reoxidize. Even today, when you extract zinc, there is a requirement to chill that vapor, and today we use molten lead for that purpose. And this is how the retorts were supported over terracotta brickwork. This is an exploded view of the furnace supports. And we have evidence that zinc was... It took the Western world as recently as 1800 AD before similar extraction was attempted in the West. This is a picture of the famous Delhi iron pillar which has withstood the ravages of sun, wind and rain for 1500 to 1600 centuries. And this was erected in 310 AD. And the Western world was amazed at this feat because nothing like this had been attempted in the West. And the iron that is used in this pillar was solid forge welded from a number of discs. Each disc might have been about 40 kilograms. And the total weight of the pillar is about 6.5 tons. About 6 tons. This is the typical composition of the wrought iron. You must note the very low sulfur because they chose the iron ore very carefully, and temperatures that were attained were relatively low, so there was no sulfur pickup. Even the carbon pickup was small because iron was not molten, and phosphorus was relatively high. The height is 22 feet, diameter 16 at the base and 12 at the top. Total weight 6 tons, a massive victory monument, and that has stood like that without any significant corrosion for 16 centuries. Still it is being analyzed. We attribute it to, of course, to the purity of the wrought iron and also the climate of Delhi, but I think it is worth reproducing the entire process to satisfy ourselves to find the explanation for its corrosion resistance, because there are even beams in Konark today closer to seashore which are not shown any signs of rusting. Another area where Indian contribution is outstanding is the field of steel itself. India was the first to produce a quality steel. Even as early as the 2nd century AD, Indian steel was traded as a commodity for making swords and armor in Persia, the famous Damascus swords. And in 1500 AD, Indian steel was a major commodity. And the process, you know how wrought iron is made in those bloomery furnaces. These are the various criteria, the factors and steps in the production of the Damascus sword quality steel. The wrought iron is carburized with chips of wood and carbonaceous matter. And as carbon soaks into the iron, it melts. The melting point comes down, it becomes plastic. Then you have iron fairly saturated with carbon to give you the starting wood steel. And the carbon content can be as high as 1.8 or so. And then this block of carbon-loaded iron in the form of hemispherical discs is the material that was shipped to sword-making centers. But then you realize that this high carbon is an embrittling constituent. But the process is done in such a way that when you heat this block in air, there is decarburization taking place. A ductile case of less carbon steel is produced, and then this is repeatedly folded in to forge the structure of the blade. This is the iron-carbon diagram as we know today, pure iron-carbon, and pure iron melts somewhere around 1500, but the wrought iron that was produced was at temperatures much lower than this. But as you load this iron with carbon, you can get into a region of the liquid phase. That's what was happening in the wood steel process. Then it is quenched. You reheat it and hold it in air. There is decarburization. You can again quench it and so on to bring to the carbon content to a manageable proportion. The wood steel finally still had about 1.5% carbon. And today, extensive work is going on at university centers in the United States to reproduce wood steel process and also to produce the beautiful structure of the Damascus blade. Of course, tomorrow I'll be telling you about the importance of structure, but I'm flashing these two just to tell you how, as a function of carbon content, the microstructure of steel can vary from low carbon to high carbon. And even if you have a 1% carbon alloy, as a function of the heat treatment, you can modify the structure in the ways you want. I will take some time to show you the design of the furnaces that were in use in earlier times. And this is the sort of bloomery furnace that you can still see in parts of the country. Just a small mud brick work with provision for blowing air through a bellows. You have a charge of ore and carbon, and you can produce the sponge iron. This is a more dimensioned sketch of that same furnace used by ironsmiths in India. 13 inch at the top and a few feet in height. Again, with arrangement for blowing air through bellows. It took various stages of evolution for the blast furnace to be developed. The early blast furnace, in fact, used charcoal as a fuel. But you realize that if you have to raise the height of this blast furnace, you have to have a char that will stand up to the weight of the furnace that you will see in all the public sector steel companies today. Starting with the Tatas, you have a tall furnace with a tapering section. The charge at the top is the iron ore, can be processed iron ore, limestone as a slag and coke as the fuel. And we have now powerful blowers to blow air from the bottom, and the combustion produces a temperature for melting the iron at the base, and the rising gases also progressively reduce the iron oxide finally to iron metal, and you have the arrangement for tapping the metal at the bottom. Before that, you tap the slag. And compared to the small crucibles that were used for making wood steel, you have the workhorse of the modern steel industry is the LD converter, a refractory line converter, where molten iron is held, molten metal is held, and you blow oxygen through the top through a lens, and you have considerable stirring of the melt, and the iron oxide oxidizes the carbon and also the silicon, and you get a silicon-free low carbon metal. And you can also modify the process to produce alloy steel. And this is the workhorse of steel making today, apart from other methods of making steel. And you have capacities and converters that can produce steel in a matter of minutes and hours. For example, the production rate in the LD converter can be of the order of 200 tons of steel in 30 to 60 minutes. A few years back, this was the distribution of the processes used for steel making. Oxygen steel making contributed to 65%, open hearth 15%, and the electric furnace 20%. In India at that point in time, the electric furnace was 22, open hearth was still contributing 46, and oxygen steel making 32. I think slowly the open hearth is being phased out now. And I had mentioned about the small retorts that were used for making zinc. Today, at the same Rajasthan location, we have a modern blast furnace. It is called the Imperial Smelting Furnace, designed in Britain, where the roasted concentrate of zinc and lead is charged at the top, and along with coke, an arrangement again to blow air at the bottom. And here, zinc oxide is reduced to zinc, and the zinc vapors escape at the top, while the molten zinc is collected at the bottom. And an essential feature of this process is that vapor is quenched by splashing lead. So, hot lead scrubs the zinc from the vapor, and there is a zinc lead separation arrangement to isolate the zinc stream. And this furnace can produce 70,000 tons of zinc and about 30,000 tons of lead per year. It's a major producer in Rajasthan. And the impure zinc is then subjected to a distillation operation to recover valuable cadmium. You've got a vertical column fractional distillation process to isolate zinc. And I was talking about iron, steel, and zinc. Aluminum comes in a different category. I think the processing of aluminum, I should say, more corresponds to the scheme that we adopt for rare metals. In the case of rare metals, you start with the ore, produce a pure intermediate, and then carry out the reduction process. In the case of aluminum also, it is like that. You start with bauxite and remove the iron oxide, silica, and other impurities by a caustic treatment. And the pure alumina then dissolved in a molten cryolite bath, a fluoride bath, is subjected to fused salt electrolysis. You have got a carbon-lined cell, this is the cathode lining, and you have got vertical anodes to supply power through the bath, and the aluminum oxide decomposes. Aluminum getting liberated in the cathode, it settles down, and periodically you tap this molten aluminum into ladles for further processing. And the melting point of aluminum is as low as 660 degrees centigrade. So it is collected in a molten form. And we have many centers in India producing aluminum by this same process that gives you the distribution of production of the Indian Aluminum Company. Hindalco, the Madras Aluminum, Bharat Aluminum. And the most modern is the National Aluminum Company at Orissa, where they have got 180 kiloamp cells, about 240 pots, producing about 250,000 tons of metal per year. And our total production of aluminum is the order of about 600,000 tons, and we are aiming to raise this to 1 million tons by the turn of the century. Because I'll be talking a bit more about the promotion of materials in the economy, but we must know, even without too much of emphasis, that our per capita consumption of these commodities is still very small. The per capita consumption of aluminum is 0.4 kilogram compared to 24 and 20 in the United States and Japan. And this is a distribution of use of aluminum in India. Electrical accounts for 50%, packaging about 6%, transport 11%, construction 6%, and others 27%. Whereas the major consumption in the advanced countries is in packaging. Packaging is 35%, and transport is 25%, construction 15%, and electrical is 15%. We are using aluminum predominantly in the electrical industry, while it's a major packaging material in the West. I will use the closing moments of today's talk to to prepare the ground for tomorrow. In the early 70s, the United States government appointed a committee to survey the scene on materials and engineering and science. And they come forward with this definition of materials as the subset of matter in the universe that man uses for making things. As you'd have seen, materials have been the working substances of our civilization and rank among the basic resources of society. And in the modern context, we can define materials as substances having properties which make them useful in structures, devices, machines, and products. And today, the subject of integrated subject of material science and engineering is concerned with the generation and application of knowledge relating structure with properties and uses, and it's a multidisciplinary activity which links the fundamental study of matter with the quest of satisfying man's needs. And this we call as the material cycle. We have as the primary activities mining and agriculture. The output from those two activities are ores, coal, sand, wood, oil, rock, and plants. We go through an extraction and refining processing. We produce metals, chemicals, paper, cement, and fibers. They are further processed to produce alloys, crystals, ceramics, concrete, plastics, textiles, and composites. You fabricate them to make assemblies, and these provide the engineering components and systems and a variety of utility products. And in the process, you have all along the line byproducts which are either recycled in the flow sheet itself or are returned to the earth in some form. For example, we produce considerable tailings in the processing of gold or uranium, which amount as tailing dumps. We produce red mud in the processing of aluminum, and that again is a waste byproduct for which we don't have. We are not devised any significant use. When we are concerned with materials as a whole, the important considerations today in material selection are availability of resource, the energy intensity that goes into the processing of materials, and the ultimate price, ease of fabrication them into shape, the aesthetic appeal that also matters. That was one that attracted man to metals like gold and also the precious stones. Then recycling of scrap and to study the environmental impact. And today, as I displayed in one of the slides, there is a competition among materials. Because I will not go into further detail now, but broadly, as I had mentioned at the outset, we can classify materials into three or four groups, as metals and alloys, ceramics and glasses, and today we are in a position to develop advanced ceramics. Then the whole family of polymers like polythene, perspex, PVC, nylon and Teflon are the rubbers. Composites, both natural like wood, and also synthetic like carbon fiber, carbon-carbon composites that have been used in the space vehicles. And you can also classify materials based on their application as building materials, materials for energy utilization, like gas turbine, nuclear reactors, solar cells, aerospace materials, electronic materials, materials for the chemical industry, and materials in bio implants. So some of these individual classifications and the modern philosophy of materials processing and the field of advanced materials, I think I'll take up tomorrow.
Dr. Ramana, Dr. Srikantan, and friends. As you will remember, you had suggested that in addition to the talk you had listened to from Dr. Ramana on philosophy and science, you would like to have him for an informal discussion on NPT and technology transfer. So Dr. Ramana has suggested that at the end of my lecture, we can have that. We can have a brief discussion on my lecture, and then it can be followed up by the other discussion. And I had planned for showing you a video on the fracture mechanics failure of Liberty ships, depending on the time that will follow later. That's all right. Yesterday, we had traced the development of metals and materials since the early stages of human civilization, and in some respects we brought it up to date. We saw that apart from the traditional metals which were known from the earliest times, were 7 or 8 of them, which are easy to extract or which occurred in nature, only during the last 2 to 3 centuries, mainly during the period 1700 to 1900, the bulk of the chemical elements were isolated and characterized. And more recently, man has synthesized also around 15 to 16 new elements beyond uranium as a result of accelerated irradiation or neutron irradiation in a reactor. Now, you'll realize that when we make use of metals or materials, we more often don't use them in the elemental form, except in very special circumstances. Gold, of course, is used in elemental form for obvious reasons. Often or invariably, we use these elements, metals and other elements, in combination. Now, if you have as many as 90 or 100 of them, even if you add one element, you realize that the combinations that will be available will be 100 into 99 by 2. Now, it is not just a combination of two elements. You can vary the compositions all the way from 0 to 50 from either side. Then again, it's not just a choice of two in a system. Today, you have industrial alloys containing as many as 4 or 6 intentional additions apart from specific impurities present in the material. So composition it definitely is a parameter with which the engineer plays with to modify the properties of an element or a material. Then again, we have other parameters like temperature, pressure, mechanical treatment, rate of cooling, and so on. There are a host of parameters which have been ingeniously exploited by the materials engineer to give us a variety of material properties consistent with the demands and expectations in performance. So in the course of today's talk, I will tell you, to the extent time is available, how material science and engineering have developed, particularly in the last 50 to 100 years.
In society, this again lists the various sectors where we need materials like energy, aerospace research and exploration, transport, marine exploration, medical, communication, and so on. We had seen that Then again, to recapitulate, when we talk of material science and engineering, we are concerned with the total body of knowledge which relates composition, structure and processing with the properties and end application. It is obviously a multidisciplinary activity which links the fundamental study of matter with its behavior in use. Now, there are various steps and feedback mechanisms by which we are able to look forward to more and more advanced materials. You have the natural resource base, then the progressive technological capability for converting it, translating it into processing of a material up to the point of utilization. Then we assess the material and utilization, and the utilization itself is the demand is provided by the needs of society. And in the process of utilization, we generate new knowledge. We also raise the situation for a drive for better materials. Then this is fed into the material science and engineering system to develop new technological capability that ends up with a new material. So it's a knowledge cycle where the natural resource is at one end, and the needs of society, the greater demands in application, are at the other end. Earlier, in yesterday's talk, a good deal of the discussion related to chemical aspects of metallurgy and materials. Today, materials science and engineering encompass a whole number of disciplines like solid-state physics, physical metallurgy, solid-state chemistry, ceramic science, polymer science, material synthesis, materials analysis, to list some of them. It's not a total list. If you see the structure of this composite discipline, you have investigations at the atomic level, where we are concerned with phenomena like semiconduction or superconductivity, or high technology materials like transistors and switches. Then you have the investigations at the bulk of the continuum level, phenomena like plastic deformation and fracture, where you need high performance materials like high strength alloys, surface modification, and so on. Now the properties that we look for in these materials, some of them are bulk mechanical. Density is an important consideration when you have to incorporate materials in an airplane or a space vehicle. You want a light and strong material. Then the stiffness of the component, hardness of the material, and under strength, at what point it yields, under stress, where it fails in a tensile mode, at temperature, when it shows a tendency to creep, in repeated cycling under loads, when it fails under fatigue failure, and if there are defects in the system, when it is likely to fracture. And on the physical side, the bulk physical, we are interested in properties like thermal conductivity, optical properties like reflectivity, magnetic and electrical properties in all the electromagnetic systems, and also surface properties, whether the material is going to corrode when exposed to an atmosphere or in a chemical environment. Corrosion is an important aspect of surface behavior. Friction, when you have got moving components in machinery, and abrasion and wear. So those are some of the typical bulk physical, bulk mechanical, and surface properties of interest that we look for in engineering materials. Yesterday I had shown this slide. It is worth recalling this once again, that the considerations in material selection are many. You are concerned, of course, about the availability of resource, the energy intensity in producing the material, the price at which it is produced, the ease of fabrication. For example, there are low melting metals like aluminum, which can be melted, cast, shaped to size, and also joined. You also have materials like steel, which melt at a higher point, melting point, but you have containers to hold molten steel. Then you have got high temperature materials like tungsten, which are not melted before application. You use powder metallurgy techniques for fabricating finally the filament. Then the aesthetic appeal, particularly when you choose materials in building construction, you are interested in the aesthetic aspects. For example, I remember when Dr. Baba was building the Tata Institute, he chose marble for the facading of the building, not only for the aesthetic appeal, considering the ease of maintenance, and we were one of the first to use extrusions of aluminum in framing doors and windows, which have an aesthetic appeal. Then we talked during the discussion about recycle of scrap and the environmental impact of byproducts and processing. And it was also in the course of the discussion a reference to substitutes and competition. This is a comparison between some of the common materials and also special materials to show how energy intensive they are. For example, if you compare aluminum and mild steel, aluminum consumes more energy in its production, titanium even more. In comparison, wood is not so energy intensive, nor concrete, nor glass. On the other hand, if you look at carbon fiber composite, which is used in the nose cone of an Agni vehicle, it's a highly energy intensive product. You also compare materials on the basis of their tensile strengths. Wrought iron, of which we were talking yesterday in the context of the Delhi pillar, has a tensile strength of 30,000 pounds per square inch. Mild steel, which contains significant quantities of carbon, is twice as strong in under tensile load. And if you consider engineering steels of the type you use in the landing gear of aircraft, the tensile strength may be as high as 225,000. Aluminum is a relatively soft material, but aluminum alloys are available which are superior to mild steel in strength, which are also heat treatable. When we talk of engineering steel of aluminum alloys, we are not talking of a single material, a variety of alloy compositions and also a variety of alloy treatments. Similarly, today we have titanium alloys comparable to steels in strength, 200,000 pounds per square inch. And if you consider the specific strength of a material, not only the strength but also its density, if you have the ratio of strength to density, then titanium is superior to all steels excepting Mahrejing steels. Then I put for comparison some of the natural materials like wood and silk, which also have significant tensile strength. In addition to tensile strength, you're interested in how the material will behave under elastic conditions, not when it is deforming even under yield, but when it is under any load in the elastic range, it shows a certain stretch, the same way a spring stretches under a load. And the elastic modulus is a ratio of stress to strain. And here you have got rubber, we know, which is an elastic material. Plastic also shows some elasticity. Wood is stiffer, bone is stiff, glass is stiff, and metals are quite stiff. Diamond is one of the most stiff materials. Now today, when we are characterizing various materials, we look at structure of and on various scales. For example, in the earlier discussions, we have known that even at the nuclear level, if you compare uranium-235 or 238 or lithium-6 or lithium-7, the properties of these isotopes are different because of the nucleonic composition of the nucleus. That is the minutest level. Then you have got the atomic level, including the electronic structure, which decides the chemical properties of the material. And you can have a range of chemical combination, like the ionic bond, which you find in sodium chloride, where both sodium and chlorine are in the ionic state, even in the solid. Then you have the covalent bond. You have the typical example of diamond, which is one of the strongest of materials, because all the valency electrons of carbon are bound in the covalent bonds in the tetrahedral structure. You have the metallic bond with which we are interested, where the electrons, the valence electrons, are not localized in the lattice. And that is how you account for the conductivity of metals, like copper, silver, or even iron. Then if you have got a molecule in the solid state, the state of bonding between the molecules is called the molecular bond. And then you have, particularly in the biochemicals, the biological structures, the hydrogen bond. One of the commonest instances is in ice. Many of the biological molecules are hydrogen bonded. The famous example of DNA, and then all polymers in particular directions are bonded through the hydrogen bond. So we saw the nature of the nuclear structure, then the atomic and chemical structure. Then the properties of the materials are also decided by the crystal structure. Now in a crystal you have got a repetitive arrangement, periodic arrangement of atoms in all the three directions. The representation here shows the two dimensions and the distances between atoms are regular. And if you have on the other hand an amorphous material about which you are discussing, there is no such regular arrangement of the atoms in the lattice, in the solid. Now, the experimental evidence for such a periodic structure inside the solid came through the measurements in X-ray diffraction corresponding to the famous Bragg law discovered by Lawrence and William Bragg in the early part of this century. Now, when you have a molten metal and you follow the solidification of the metal, at some point very close to the melting point, just beyond the melting point, or at the melting point, nuclei start forming because the solid is relatively stable compared to the liquid as we cross the melting point downwards. And then at the completion of solidification, the various crystal faces join to form a polycrystalline structure that is illustrated here on both sides. And where the two crystals or grains meet, you form a grain boundary where there is something like a loosely ordered structure. The grain boundary is a state of higher energy than the body of the crystal. Now, 50 years back, when material scientists wanted to explain the plastic behavior of metals, because the strength of the metals were far lower than what was indicated by the cohesive strength between the atoms, they postulated that in the periodic lattice of atoms, there are always present some defects, like what you see here. You have got rows of atoms, and on this row or plane, you find one vacancy or one missing position. And this defect runs as a line in the other direction of the solid. And it is the movement of this line, which is called a dislocation, that permits plastic movement of material. To give you an analogy, if you have a huge carpet in this room, it will be difficult to move the carpet as a whole. But supposing you form a fold at one end, you can move that fold with very little effort all the way from one end to the other. So the concept of dislocation movement was compared to this form of moving material through fairly easily compared to the bond strength you had to break otherwise if such a defect were not present. So the defect of a dislocation, which was later seen in the electron microscope, is both a facility for plastic deformation and also a weakness because it impairs the strength of the material. Now, in the course of the last 100 years and more, the physical metallurgists, the physicists, the instrumental scientists have all contributed to expanding in the capability of the substructure observation, which is beyond the capability of the human eye. I have listed here, starting with the capacity of human vision, all the way to the latest scanning tunneling microscope where you can see atoms, how the capability has increased. The human eye can distinguish distances apart by 10 to the power minus 2 centimeters, or about 0.1 millimeter. The optical microscope, which came to be used for metallurgical observations in the mid-19th century, can distinguish up to 5 to 10 to the power of minus 4 centimeters. The scanning electron microscope uses a good depth of focus up to 10 to the power of minus 4 centimeters, a micron. The electron microprobe has also the same resolution. And then you have got the transmission electron microscope, which today for the physical metallurgist is an inescapable equipment to observe microstructures at the near atomic level. Then in 1951, as I mentioned yesterday, Mueller discovered the field ion microscope. I will illustrate how you can image atoms there. And most recently, you can scan surfaces now, imaging atoms on the surface with the scanning tunneling microscope. This is a picture of a field ion image where you have the specimen fashioned in the form of a sharp tip so that it gathers a high potential. And this is a schematic representation of the atoms on the surface of that pointed specimen. And if you impose a high voltage on the tip and you have an atmosphere, let us say, of helium atoms, the helium ions which are generated at the which are formed at the various atomic locations then stream towards the screen, which is at a negative potential, imaging individual atoms as you see them here. So this was the first visual evidence that atoms are there, which we have been always postulating. Yesterday, we, in the context of the Damascus sword and its heat treatment, we had occasion to look at this phase diagram, the famous iron-carbon diagram. Now, the metallurgist makes use of many such diagrams when he considers the equilibrium between two elements or more than two elements as a function of composition and temperature. In one representation, you can see that for a particular composition, as you raise the temperature, what are the various crystal structures and phases you come across. And this is made use of in the heat treatment of alloys, and phase diagram establishment and use is an important part of metallurgical development. Now, these are pictures that we also saw yesterday to illustrate how, as a function of carbon content, the structure of steel varies with the with increasing content of the carbide phase. Or if you have a single alloy with 1% carbon, you can generate a range of phases depending on the heat treatment to which it is subjected. This is the equilibrium perlite phase showing a laminated structure of ferrite and iron carbide. And when you quench the steel from a high temperature, it forms a martensitic structure, which is much harder and brittle. And if this transformation is conducted at intermediate temperatures, or the martensite is tempered at a higher temperature, we are able to modify the morphology of these phases. Those are all microscopes, micrograph shown with the optical microscope. These are pictures that illustrate the capability of the electron microscope. Here again, we are seeing one typical material, a high-temperature nickel-based alloy, subjected to various treatments and various durations. You can see for the same temperature or similar temperatures, the soaking time influences the phase distribution. And for two comparable temperatures, you can identify the different distribution of phases. And when you are talking of submicroscopic particles, you are able to identify such carbides which are strengthening constituents. And we also have the capability of analyzing the composition of those phases. That is as far as observing microstructures goes. As a result of studies with various compositions and heat treatments, the metallurgist today has a variety of schemes, mechanisms by which he can harden and strengthen a material. For example, if you take a piece of steel wire and if you go on bending it, you subject it to stress that also causes work hardening. What happens there is the dislocation lines that you saw in an earlier representation multiply. Then you can add another element to strengthen the material. One of the earliest examples was arsenic in copper, which was in use even in Vedic times. Then the addition of zinc to copper to form the brasses. So you add an element of comparable atomic size, you can have solid solution hardening. Then you have a scheme called precipitation hardening. In the case of aluminum, it is quite often employed. Also in the case of copper beryllium. You can take an element in solution at a high temperature, and then when you cool it, slowly a second phase precipitates, and this is called the principle of age hardening. Then you can have another phase introduced, like the carbide phase or the aluminide phase in the high temperature materials. You can subject materials to what is called the martensitic transformation, where there is no diffusion, but in the martensite phase, there is a hardening contribution. Then without altering the composition, simple grain size manipulation, as you go from a fine grain structure to a coarse grain structure, also you have from a coarse grain structure to a fine grain structure, there is hardening. Yesterday when we were discussing ceramics as possible structural materials, there was a question raised about their brittleness. I'll come to that presently. But before that, I would like to briefly deal with the situations where we need materials standing up to high temperatures. So these are some of the examples of high temperature service requirements of materials. The airframes of supersonic planes they attain to significant temperatures. I will illustrate it in another slide. In steam generation, which is normally encountered in power generation, the materials used in the steam generators have to stand up to 500 degrees centigrade. In the jet engine, you have to have materials that will be stable at 1100. In the petroleum chemical industry, 1250 degrees centigrade. Then if you are looking at the Apollo spacecraft during the re-entry phase, the cone can attain to 1700 degrees centigrade. Then the tungsten filament that you use in the filament lamp, it glows at 2500 degrees centigrade. The rocket nozzles in the space vehicles, they approach temperatures in excess of 3000. And one of the supersonic space vehicles under design, the nose component may exceed 4000 degrees centigrade. Now when you are looking at the temperature capability of various materials, aluminum has the lowest temperature capability. Then you have got the nickel, base alloys, stainless steels and titanium. But more and more, the shift in emphasis is going to be either in ceramics, which have very high temperature capability, or composites in a metal or ceramic matrix. This again compares the temperature capability as a function of melting point. The melting point itself is not an index of high temperature capability. Some materials lose their strength even at half the melting point, as aluminum. Titanium loses its strength at one third of its melting point because there is a crystallographic transformation in between. And for stress conditions, the nickel superalloy that can stand up to 1000 degrees is still a workhorse for the jet engines. Then you have got the corrosion resistant steels used in the petrochemical service, which can stand up to 1150, about a third of the melting point. Nichrome that we use in the common heating elements in the heating plates it operates at 1250 degrees centigrade. Then we have got another composition that's iron based that can go up to 1350, whereas ceramic like alumina can go up to 1850, and tungsten, the filament, is at 2500, about 75% of its melting point. And much higher temperatures are possible with these ceramics like hafnium carbide, tungsten carbide, thorium oxide, hafnium oxide, aluminum oxide, and so on. Silicon carbide does not melt. It is one of the candidates for the auto engine. It sublimes at 2400 degrees centigrade, and silicon nitride also sublimes without melting at 1850 degrees centigrade. Now, the evolution of aircraft over the years, this is how the skin temperatures have increased. The earliest planes, which even used wood, the surface temperature was about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Then in the 1980s, the interceptor that was developed in the fighter aircraft had a skin temperature of 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. The space shuttle, like the Challenger, the skin temperature goes to 2000 Fahrenheit. And the Orient Express is still under design, where the travel time between the United States and Japan can be cut down to 2 hours. That's the target. The skin temperatures may go up to 3000 degrees Fahrenheit. If you look at the engines in comparison, now we were earlier talking about the fuselage. the engine temperatures will go have risen from 300 degrees Fahrenheit all the way to 2000 in present day jets, and likely to increase to 3500 for a better efficiency in performance from the turbojet. The skin temperatures, they are all aluminum alloys only. Yes, the even here, but up to even in the Concorde, where the velocities are only about 1.2 or 1.3 Mach, you are able to use aluminum for the frame. Only when you go to higher Mach numbers, the skin temperatures go up higher, and you have to use titanium alloys. In the fighter that is shown here, you have to use titanium alloys even for the skin. The Airbus can use aluminum. Metals are ductile. The ceramics, though they have high temperature capability, they have a tendency to brittleness. And the defects that you can tolerate in such refractories and ceramics are of small dimensions. And in the context of minor defect tolerance, we are concerned with the property called toughness or fracture strength. And that is illustrated in this and the following illustrations. Now, if you have three sheets of paper, one without any opening in it, the second one with a central hole, the third one with a notch like this, which is rather rounded, and another one with a sharp crack, and if you are attempting to tear the paper, which is not a ductile material, the tearing strength will be, or you can call it a fracture strength, will be maximum for this situation where there is no starting defect, and it will be less for the second one, lesser still for the third one, and it is minimum for the last one where there is a short notch or a crack. And in fact, if you see some of the plastic containers where you are given toffees on the aircraft, some are biscuits, they are providing a small notch for you to easily open the wrapping. Now, the reason for the lower stress for tearing or fracturing is explained here. In the integral specimen, if these are the lines of flow of stress, in the situation where you have got a sharp crack, as these ligaments or elements are absent, those lines converge at the crack tip. And this is the point at which there is a maximum stress concentration. And as you go farther away, the stress concentration comes down. And this is also illustrated in this representation. The fracture stress as a function of distance from the crack tip is maximum here. There is no flow of stress in those regions where there is no material, and slowly it tapers away from the crack. Now, how can you strengthen such a material even when there is the incidence of a crack or the initiation of a crack? Because various mechanisms are possible and available today, but I will illustrate one or two. For example, if you have got a composite which is a two-phase structure, as the crack is moving towards and it hits the fiber matrix interface, then the crack cannot travel through because it's a different material. It gets diffused with a disengagement of the fiber from the matrix. Similar mechanisms have been used for strengthening polymers with rubber particles, where the same principle applies, and finally the crack gets blunted as it passes through these rubber particles after segmenting some of them. Now, this is the same principle that can also be used if you want to toughen a ceramics, as Ramesh was asking yesterday, there are various possibilities.